Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 85, recorded September 2nd, 2010. The Death of ATI. This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Ryan Trout, joined by Patrick Norton. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, Ryan, how's it going this week?
Pretty good. You look like you're in a kind of an outdoorsy location today.
I am not in my usual box in the darkness.
Neither am I. You can tell I'm not in my usual place of really good lighting, but I'm in a kind of a darkened bedroom of a friend's house. So, hey, but we're here. We're going to talk about technology. We're going to talk about hardware. We're going to take a lot of reader questions this time around. We actually are doing a lot of emails as opposed to Twitter feeds because, as it turns out, people's problems are more complicated than 140 characters can really be condensed down into that size. So for right now, we're hoping to get a Twitch at something dot something email address. But for now, ryan@twit.tv is the place to send your emails if you have questions or upgrade questions or what components should I choose with this and that kind of thing. We're going to start doing a little bit more of that as well, as in addition to the key news points of the week. So I guess let's jump into a couple of things in news first, though. You know, last week we talked about Hot Chips, which is another show you really hadn't heard about. And I'm guessing, Patrick, you had not heard of the Global Foundries Technology Conference either.
That is a new and exciting one for me. But it seems like AMD is whipping out another dog pile of announcements at this show.
Yeah, so Global Foundries, if you don't know, is the company that resulted as of the spinoff from AMD's manufacturing capabilities. They spun off into a separate company that's now not totally independently owned. I think AMD owns like 25% of it still. But they're independent in that they have other customers than AMD now. So they had a conference in the Santa Clara era to kind of welcome new customers, show how their products and their process technologies could benefit to other customers. And you're right, what AMD was on hand, and they made, you know, not a huge product announcements necessarily. They didn't release new processors or new pricing for anything. But what they did talk about was a lot of future technologies that always kind of get hardware geeks really excited. The first was the AMD Llano APU. Now, an APU is accelerated processing unit. It's kind of AMD's moniker for a combination CPU-GPU hybrid. As far as I can tell, the upcoming Intel Sandy Bridge is still just going to be called a processor, a CPU. I don't think they've come up with any unique marketing names yet. Not that Intel needs any help creating new marketing things for us to try to figure out and explain to everybody. But AMD has gone the route of calling it an APU, combining CPU and GPU components. And we've talked about Ontario, which was a APU built for the mobile market, Atom type targets or below. Llano is the kind of desktop equivalent of that. So this is the one that people might be buying and putting in their low-cost systems and their low-cost computers. Llano is, it combines the CPU architecture that we know today as Phenom 2, slightly modified cores of that with what we're guessing are going to be performance levels of, say, a Radeon 5500 graphics card, all on a single die, maybe 5400 graphics card, all on a single die, sold for a very low cost and out into the market. So it could be pretty compelling from that way. And a lot of people with this chip, with this and with Sandy Bridge, which is Intel's variant of combining integrated graphics with CPU cores on a single die, both of which will be out in 2011. It looks like Intel's parts are actually going to be out first. Many people are calling for the death of the sub $100 graphics card market, because most of the time people who are buying sub $100 graphics cards don't really care about high-end gaming, high-performance gaming.
Right.
And when they figure out they can get a processor, a system that can do all that for a little bit less. And in this case, you know, most of these people aren't going to care that it's a CPU-GPU combo. It could be pretty interesting. I mean, does it disappoint you to hear that kind of the $99 graphics card, $99 and below might be.
The $99 graphics card market isn't going to go away. They're just going to use 2-year-old leftovers. They're going to push the price down. You know what I mean? It's like today's $99 graphics card is awfully close to, you know, the $500 graphics card from 2 years ago.
Right.
And the truth is the upgrade graphics card market is still so much smaller than the graphics card market with, you know what I mean? You buy a Dell, you buy a Mac, you buy an HP, whatever it is. Most people, you know, the number I saw years ago is 90% of the people who buy a machine never open up the case. They never do a memory upgrade. They never do a graphics card swap. So there's a relatively small group of people who buy a lot of hardware on retail. I'm not to be honest with you, I'll believe it's going away when I actually see it, .. Most of the low-end machines, when they're looking for super cheap motherboard CPU combinations, don't even have a PCI Express slot or, to go back, an AGP slot. So there wasn't any upgrade possibility without upgrading the motherboard anyway.
Yeah, the reason I think it will happen is because there will be less people buying $100 graphics cards. So you'll see companies like ATI and NVIDIA maybe even stop worrying about targeting that market because there are more compelling lower cost options on these combined products. But I'm still with you. I still think there's going to be a lot of hope for that kind of going. There'll always be stuff for sale for $99. It's just a matter of how big that market will be.
That makes sense.
Yeah, the other announcement they showed was a little bit more compelling for the high-end market. This was the first kind of announcement and showing of what an Orochi die is. Roochi. Yeah, is how that's spelled, Orochi. And this is a bulldozer-based processor. And really all they did was show a picture of the die and say, hey, this is coming on a slide presentation. But it was, you know, we'd been hearing about the bulldozer architecture. We talked about it a little bit last week. That's what they kind of unveiled at the Hot Chips conference. And now what we're actually seeing is a product based on that part. It's a
eight thread. But what does it do? Is it GPU, CPU, or is it one of those classic sort of whatever you want to feed to it?
CPUs. This is a CPU only part. This is kind of why it's a little bit confusing, because Bulldozer is the next generation CPU architecture. Now, the first products that come out with that architecture are going to be CPU only, but Llano is based on the previous or current generation processor technology, but will integrate high performance graphics earlier. So there will be Bulldozer based APUs down the road, but when this Orochi die actually is released, I'm thinking this is going to be a March of next year type product. That it's going to be a CPU only. So I would guess at this point, since we'll have both Llano and Orochi in the market at the same time, Llano will be really going at the kind of low cost budget system because it has a somewhat underpowered CPU core compared to, you know, whatever Intel will have at the time and Bulldozer, but it will have integrated graphics. And then this Bulldozer part will really be aimed at kind of the mainstream to higher end markets where CPU performance is more important and people are more likely to use discrete graphics cards.
Interesting. That seems pretty simple.
Yeah.
Do you think it's going to be able to compete with what Intel is dropping on the market at that point, or are they still going to be playing catch up?
It's really hard to tell. Bulldozer is their best chance at catching up. Phenom 2 is not going to catch up. Anything they do with that architecture, we pretty much can be assured now it's not going to catch up at all. If it had a chance, it would have done it already. Bulldozer has a shot. It really depends on how fast they can clock it. And honestly, we don't know a whole lot about what kind of performance the CPU is going to be like, because it is a completely new architecture. We really don't know anything about it. It's integrating a really unique kind of multi-threaded capability to it. That's why I said it's 4 modules. Each module is essentially 2 cores or 2 threads, but some of those components are shared. So it's a hybrid between a quad core and an 8-core processor. So we'll have to see how that turns out.
One of the things you talked about in the article was in comparing Intel and AMD with the decode units inside of there. How's that actually impacting? Apparently, my neighbor's car just died.
Nice.
I don't know if you can hear the diesel thrum. I mean, one of the things you spent a good paragraph and a half talking about the decode units and where they're going with Bulldozer versus the current Intel offerings. What's going on with the decode units and how do they impact performance?
So that's one part of the shared architecture, and we really don't know how that's going to change the way that the decode works when it's going down two different threads. Because really, right now, the way Intel's hyper-threaded technology works is that it shares every single resource. So when it swaps threads, those decode units, as well as every other step in the pipeline, really change over with it. It's kind of like moving one way or the other in terms of which thread you're working on at a time. And it has registers to hold all the data for each stage and swaps back and forth. With this, we're really not sure. Obviously, AMD knows, and all we can do is kind of guess and estimate. But at this point, I really have not a whole lot of detail on what they're going to do with it. So,
speaking of the future of AMD and ATI, ATI is dead.
Yeah, it's really kind of sad, isn't it? I mean,
I'm going to quote paragraph PCPer.com. AMD claims that after doing some extensive surveys of a worldwide discrete graphics aware audience, that's enthusiasts and or gamers, if you want to think about it that way, they found a few interesting points that indicated permission from the community to make this move to kill off ATI and go straight AMD. AMD preference tripled when the respondent was aware of the ATI-AMD merger. The AMD brand was stronger than the ATI brand when compared to graphics competitors. Radeon and FirePro brands were already considerably known on their own. So, yeah. So they're basically – and I think this actually makes sense long-term rather than having – you know, because everything's an Intel processor. You know, everybody knows it's an Intel processor. Maybe AMD was deciding it's really time for us to concentrate on the core AMD brand and converting some of the enthusiasm about the graphics products into enthusiasm in a larger base on the CPU and other products.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's been about 4 years since the AMD-ATI merger, and honestly, I think this was something that we all thought would come sooner than this, the removal of the ATI brand, but they kept around. It's a really well-known brand, especially with gamers and stuff like that. But those points you rattled off, they basically said, this is a good time for us to kind of get rid of the ATI brand and really refocus everything on the name AMD. And I think, you know, they checked for permission, so to speak, first from the community to do that. But really, this has to do with the upcoming Fusion and APU parts, where there's going to be CPU bits and GPU bits in the same chip. And what do you call that? Do you call that an AMD processor with ATI graphics technology? I sure hope not. So they wanted to really say, well, this is an AMD APU. No qualms, no debate about it. They didn't want people to say this is an AMD APU with AMD processor technology and ATI graphics technology. So, I mean, current products are going to stay ATI Radeon. When the 6000 series comes out, that will be called AMD Radeon. It's not a huge deal, really, for gamers, except those of us who will remain nostalgic about the ATI brand and that kind of thing. But, you know, we get what we can take at this point. So,
tell me what's going on with the Lucid Hydrologic Unity technology, PowerColor, the first vendor to use this. What exactly is Hydrologic?
So Lucid Hydro Technology, they kind of in the last week or two have decided they wanted to call it Hydrologic. So I'm sure there's some overlap with another company that might have the term Hydra or something like that. But Hydra was a technology with the goal of creating a multi-GPU platform that could support NVIDIA cards from current, you know, identical NVIDIA cards as well as non-identical NVIDIA cards, even from different generations. Same thing with ATI or AMD, I guess we'll have to start saying. As well as maybe to facilitate combinations of NVIDIA and AMD graphics cards in the same system, working together to improve performance of a single game, which is obviously not possible with current SLI technology or Crossfire technology. And even in those cases, even if you stay inside the NVIDIA ecosystem, if you have a GTX 470 today and you want to buy a GTX 480 or a 460, you can do that, but you have to replace the graphics card, or you can put them both in the same system, but only one will be rendering at the same time, and you don't get the ability to, you know, it kind of makes intuitive sense, right? That this is maybe what should have happened all the time. If you have a GTX 480 in your system, you've got performance of 1x. You put another GTX 480 in there, you hope you can get up to 2x. But say you put a GTX 470 in there, maybe you think you could be able to get 1.5 or 1.6x performance. But obviously, that doesn't happen at all today. And Lucid's goal was to try to facilitate that, as well as the way out there chance that you might want to combine a GTX 480 with a Radeon HD 5870 or something like that. The only way you'd be able to... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say you mentioned that the first round of sort of cards with this technology, it was kind of hit and miss. I mean, have they sort of cleaned up the performance gains at this point?
I haven't tested it in a while, unfortunately, but they're telling me that they have made drastic improvements since the 1.0 revision of the driver. They're up to 1.6. That obviously, that, you know, a decimal point doesn't mean jack. But they have greatly expanded the game compatibility as well as the support for different graphics cards. They've introduced support for the DirectX 11 products from both AMD and NVIDIA. So they're basically up to the level of all the cards that are out today. The problem was, in order to get Lucid technology, you had to buy a specific motherboard. And these motherboards were both expensive. They were very, very limited in the number of models that were actually out. I think maybe two is what we're up to today. And the other problem was, the first motherboard that came out with it was a very high-end board, $350. It supported the Lucid Hydra multi-GPU scaling, and it supported Crossfire, but it didn't support SLI. And that was kind of a downer for me, because the idea of Lucid is it's an added bonus. If it works, great. You get extra performance that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. If not, you can always go back to standard SLI technology. But without SLI support, it couldn't do that. So what's interesting about this, what they're calling Unity technology, is it actually implements the Hydra technology onto the graphics card instead of onto a motherboard. So the example we have here is there's a power color Radeon HD 5770 graphics card that's going to come out with a Hydra chip on it. And if you have that card in your system, you can then install any other graphics card or any other two graphics cards into that computer. And as long as they're communicating on a PCI Express bus, they'll have access to that Lucid chip and they will be able to scale.
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a much lower cost alternative, but it's just easier. You don't have to replace your motherboard. You don't have to worry about upgrading your whole system to this one particular platform because of it. You could buy it's still really limited, because there's only one graphics card that's going to be out in the next few months that will support this. So you still have to have a 5770 in your system. But the idea is, they're trying to sell this to card vendors as here's a $3 or $4 add-on, right? And it will work with any chip, AMD, NVIDIA, it doesn't matter if it's high performance, low performance, anything. And they say, include this on your board because it's an added feature. It costs the user almost nothing, but they get an extra option down the road. So it's kind of like a value add.
I mean, that's pretty cool. But $3 in parts costs, $3, $4 in parts costs turns into what, $12 on the street? $9 on the street minimum?
I'm thinking maybe 10 or 20, $20 difference.
I mean, that's a big chunk of cash when you're looking at anything under a $200. Well, even at a $200 graphics card, that's still almost 10% of the price at the high end of the number you were giving there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the idea. I like the idea of increasing the compatibility and performance for multiple cards, especially over time. Because if you got that 2-year-old graphics card, I don't know. It's one of those things where every time I think like I have a 2-year-old graphics card, I'm going to pair it up with a second graphics card, it almost always turns out that I can buy a new graphics card, replace the old graphics card, and get better than I would get out of cross-firing or SLIing a pair of cards.
It's an enticing idea, though, to think that if you have a Radeon HD 5850 or 5870 today, or an NVIDIA 470 or 480 that doesn't have any of this technology on it, that in a couple of months, when they say the 6000 series is released, they release a 6870 that has Lucid technology on it, that you'll be able to plug in that card without thinking you're throwing away the investment of your previous card, that it can still sit in your system with your new high-end card, and maybe it only adds 25%, maybe it adds 40% to your performance or something like that, but you're still getting something out of it, as opposed to sitting it on your shelf and watching it gather dust, or trying to sell it on Craigslist for $40 or whatever you're gonna be able to get for it. So I still think Lucid is the Hydra tech is a really compelling option. They still have a lot of potential issues, driver issues, hardware issues, getting people to adopt it and accept it.
If it
works great, it could be awesome for enthusiasts.
I was going to say, the potential driver issues sound like they could really, really create problems for this system in the long run.
Yeah.
So, email from Marty. You want to take a swing at this one?
Yeah. So this one is pretty simple. He says, what's your recommendation for an SSD in a Lenovo X300? It has a 60 gig, 1.8-inch drive. What can like I replace it with?
This is the classic, I bought a netbook last year, the storage sucked, help. Because like it, you know, in this case, it's the Lenovo X300, but a lot of first generation, some of the, even the second generation netbooks were using little tiny 1.8-inch hard drives. And if you're not looking in the right place, it can look like your upgrade options are incredibly limited for this, which they kind of are compared to 2.5-inch drives.
Yeah, they still are. The good news is, surprisingly, actually, when I went out to hunt for this, I thought, man, there's going to be like four or five options out there. If you go to Newegg, there are 14 1.8-inch SSDs. Now, not all of them are good. I'll say that. And a lot of them are way overpriced for the performance you get. I mean, you can go all the way up to, if you want to spend $600, you can get a Crucial C300 SSD that's a 256 gig SSD for $600. So that's actually a good product. The C300 is high performance.
Or buy a completely brand new netbook with a drive that probably is larger capacity plus a faster GPU plus probably a bigger.
It would have a larger capacity, but wouldn't have a larger capacity SSD. I look at it as if you get a high capacity SSD at this point, it's kind of like one of those things you take with you when you upgrade your notebook or laptop. Sure. You can't always. I mean, 2.5s are mostly standard, but you can get a 1.8 to 2.5 adapter, I think, for most models, or something like that. So, I mean, if that's the case, you know, one of the options is. I assumed he kind of wanted to stay 60 gigs or more. I mean, you can get Intel has 80 gig X18M SSDs for $214.
That's
you can
not a
go.
Bad deal.
Yeah, you can go 64 gig Crucial C300 for $146. So there are some other options there that are more modest in price. OCZ has the Vertex 2 drives.
That's the one I'm looking at. Is that one of the new SandForce drives?
I think so. Yeah. So that's $410 for a 120 gig drive model.
It's just, I mean, I don't mean to laugh, and I paid like $300 and change for my Intel X25N. It's just 120 gigabyte drive, $400. It still kills me.
It should.
I mean, I would also, you know, one thing I'd point out is we've been talking over the last few weeks saying SSD capacities are going up because they're increasing the density on the memory chips that basically form the core of solid-state drives. You know, they're expecting, like, capacities to go up considerably by Q4 this year. I wouldn't hold my breath too much in the 1.8-inch market. I think it's going to be trailing the 2.5-inch market because it's such a small customer base compared to 2.5-inch or larger SSD drives.
Definitely. Definitely. We've got another email for Phil, if you want to take that one, Patrick.
Phil is looking for a sound card. This is the classic. I have really nice home theater speakers that attach to my PC gaming system. So he's saying, I want a sound card that has optical inputs and outputs and support 5.1 surround. What I want to use this sound card for is to connect my PS3 to my PC audio setup. Creative makes this type of card in their Sound Blaster X-Fi line, but I would like to stay away from them due to my experience with the X-Fi series not playing well with Windows 7. I'm sorry, are you talking about the fact that Creative didn't have any drivers for the X-Fi series on Windows 7 for a considerably long time after the launch? And I believe they actually have delivered drivers and reasonably solid drivers at this point, so you might not need to stray too far away from that. There's some high-end 5.1 surround cards out there. Ozentech does one. Asus Zonar does one. They have this sort of unusual RCA. It looks like an RCA jack with a giant hole in the middle of it, and it's actually a combo RCA optical SPDIF jack.
Right.
My concern is I haven't had a chance to play around with this. I haven't seen whether or not Windows 7 is actually smart enough to take the input off the 5.1 and reroute it to whatever...
it's true.
Okay, that was a cruel choice of words. I don't know where the code is implemented properly in the audio system to allow the 5.1 signal, right? Because you basically take the signal in from the PS3, you decode it, and you pass it back out. Unless your speakers use a SPDIF optical jack, in which case you need two optical jacks. Maybe if you're lucky, you have one on your motherboard, and you come in through the sound card and out through the motherboard. You know, and it's tough because we're talking about like the Asus Zonar D2, great home theater PC board, especially if you're trying to to go out to an existing receiver. But man, these cards are over half the price. I just bought a Denon AVR 591, which is a tick above Denon's entry level. Denon has like a cheaper amplifier, but the 591 is a 5.1 amplifier, receiver, FM, has some pretty sophisticated room tuning technology built into it. It ships with a microphone, so you basically put the microphone in up to 8 different locations throughout the room, and it optimizes the timing and the levels on all 5 channels so that you get like the perfect surround sound experience. And it kills me that you're going to be dropping like $180 for a graphics card when what you really need is, you know, ideally you would have, you know, a set of a receiver feeding your for your speakers. And sure, the receiver, 70 watt per channel receiver, would be complete and total overkill for like 5 speakers around a gaming chair. But yeah, this is the problem. If you have HDMI on, if there's an HDMI port on, if you're using like instead of a PC monitor, an HDTV monitor, right, you go from the PS3 HDMI into the HDMI port on the monitor on the HDTV, and then you can send the audio out from the HDTV in most cases. But yeah, I think you're right with the, you were talking about the Ozentech. I can never remember. It's got like 42 initials in that name.
Yeah, it's the problem with finding coax or digital input is kind of difficult. The Asus Zonar D2 does say it supports DTS Connect, DTS Interactive Encoder, and DTS Neo PC, which kind of indicates to me that it could do what he's asking. But it is kind of hit or miss. That's like one of those very specific use cases that I have never had to try before. So
I've got
it's kind of an expensive trial.
Yeah, I actually have an Asus X-Fi card in the lab we did for home theater build-up on AC Nation. I'll see if A, it hasn't left the lab, as shiny products are so want to do, and B, see if I can actually get this configuration running, because there's a PS3 in the studio I can grab. But yeah, it's really tough. You know, part of the issue is, you know, if we knew how your 5.1 speakers connected to your PC, that would also help answer this. But to go back also to something we said earlier, I wouldn't be nearly as afraid of Creative's X-Fi and Windows 7 as, you know, last year, because they did finally ship drives for that. Drivers, not drives.
Right.
Mark, on episode 84, a listener asked about desktop switchable graphics. You and Ryan overlooked an option for this user if he or she were to use a computer. This is an email from Mark, by the way, with the AMD, you know, A7 whatever, the A780, for example. So here's chipset that has an ATI Radeon 4000 or 5000 series GPU on board, as well as a PCI Express 16 slot. A lot of conditions here, Mark. then he could use Hybrid Crossfire. I'm going to throw this one directly in front of you, Ryan. Jump on this grenade.
So he basically says you can use that. Hybrid Crossfire allows you to use the integrated ATI Radeon graphics for light graphical tasks, then switch to the more powerful Radeon external graphics card when you want to do that, which is true. This feature is being deprecated, though. It's not really being well supported in future drivers. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me at all if like 10.8 just didn't have support for it anymore. It wasn't a very successful product launch. They didn't, you know, both NVIDIA and ATI, or AMD now, tried this at one point, and it was just not very successful. And what's interesting is we actually got another email from another reader or listener named Justin, who says, hey, I was just listening to your listener question about switching off his graphics card when his kids or whoever were just browsing the web, and I have a suggestion. He says he has a system with an old Athlon X2, 3 gigahertz, and the Asus motherboard with cool and quiet feature clocks it down to 900. He says his GTX 460 clocks down to as low as 50 megahertz when he's just browsing. These both respond with full speed performance pretty instantly when I start up a modern game. I think the power saving features are standard in NVIDIA cards since the 9000 series. This combined with your other point really makes the already minimal kilowatt hour savings even smaller. And I think that kind of goes back to what we were saying before. It's like, you can probably try something like this, but if it's old and deprecated and you're really not saving that much money, how much time do you want to waste on that goal?
I'm going to say there's probably better ways. Eliminate, you know, a cup of coffee every third week and you're probably going to save three or four times as much money. Probably a lot more than, you know what I mean? Like a $2 cup of coffee, even the crappy place near me charges $1.50 for a cup of coffee now. And like, you know, four less cups of coffee a month is probably going to save you a lot more money than throttling down your low-end GPU on your desktop. Damien emails in, I recently upgraded my OS to Windows 7 64-bit from a 32-bit XP. I've got three SATA drives on my system, two DVD drives, and a Western Digital hard drive, 250 gigs. When I was using XP, all the drives were detected correctly, but they show up in Windows 7 as SCSI drives. Everything seems to be working great. I first noticed this when I tried to use a monitoring program to detect temperatures on my computer gear. The hard drive was detected as a non-smart SCSI drive, and then noticed my two SATA DVD drives are shown as SCSI DVD drives also. They show up correctly in the BIOS, but in Windows, they show proper model numbers and manufacturer, just labeled SCSI. So the question is, what, if anything, should I do to fix this? The hard drive is not being detected as being a smart drive. Does this hurt my performance? If it matters, the motherboard is an EVGA 680i board. Is this a BIOS issue?
I tried to look this motherboard up, but there are like four different EVGA 680i motherboards, because my first thought was some of the older SATA controllers, storage controllers, even if they weren't SCSI, were just called SCSI by Windows, right? The drivers just kind of labeled them as SCSI because the driver at the time didn't really know what else to call it or what other classification it could go in under the Windows Device Manager and that kind of thing. So I'm not sure if the motherboard he has, if he's using a non-Southbridge-based storage controller, something like from a Marvell or a JMicron or somebody else like that it might just be showing up as a SCSI drive. And I think if it's one of the early SATA 2 controllers, that they might have showed up as SCSI before Windows really had any support, or the driver itself really knew what a classification could be. I don't think it shouldn't affect him in any way that it shows up as that if everything's working. And you don't have any of those little yellow exclamation points in your device manager, chances are your performance isn't being affected. And if it all works, it's one of those things where I'd kind of like just not bother touching it for fear of it breaking down the road.
If it works, don't fix it. If you're feeling kind of brave and crazy, I would start looking at making sure you have the latest BIOS updates for your motherboard in place, making sure you have the correct drivers for the chipset for the motherboard in place, because you can assume that all the correct drivers got installed when you did your Windows 7 64-bit upgrade, or you can actually double check, dig down in the manufacturer's website, make sure you do get the right model motherboard. But yeah, I'm with Ryan on this one, man. If it works, I might not fix it.
We got an email from Mark who says, first of all, I've been a big fan of the show. I have somewhat of a good gaming PC with a Core 2 Duo 2.6 EVGA 275 graphics card, 2 gigs of memory, et cetera. I mostly play Battlefield Bad Company 2 on this machine, and ever since day one, been having a white screen of death. It doesn't crash to desktop at all, it just gets a white screen. And the weird part is, he can still hear the game audio. All of his temps are steady, and the fans are at 100%. Doesn't have any programs running in the background. And apparently he did a search on how to fix the problem, didn't find anything, but and he also has the latest drivers as well. He said a lot of other people are reporting the same problem. So I included this email. I have no idea what the answer is.
We're throwing this out to the audience then.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Part of it's like, I mean, part of it's, and I'm going to catch some justifiable hell from people in the audience who maybe, you know, work on video games for a living. But in situations like this, I'm always tempted to say, have they ever issued a patch for the game? When was the last patch for the game issued? Has the company ever acknowledged the problem? Because the screen suddenly going white, that reeks of an application, especially if the audio is still going, that reeks of sort of a driver application problem.
Yeah.
It's probably not the driver at this point, because the 3D drivers in your car are going to be pretty stable at this point, as long as you're not running some weird beta driver you found somewhere. So I'm going to say, you know, email tech support, at EA and make sure, well, you know, it's almost impossible to play a game these days without all the latest patches, but this reeks of a issue inside of the game. Or, you know, if you want to get really, if you want to have some really serious nerdly fun, like image your system onto a hard drive, do a clean install of your operating system, load, you know, all of the patch updates for the system and fresh drivers, and then just the video game, and see if you still get like the white screen of death. And then all of a sudden, you know that maybe one of the other applications you have installed in your game or on your PC is interfering with the game functioning, which then gets into a whole like, you know, it's their problem to fix. It's their problem to fix, and the two vendors will kind of stare at each other. Usually, it's like Microsoft and somebody else, or it could be like iTunes and your video game or whatever. You know, best thing to do though is ask very nicely at EA to see if they have a fix or any ideas for this.
Yeah, that would be my thing. It's either driver or software, and unfortunately, neither of those things you can really fix if you already had the latest version. So, sorry. If anybody in the audience knows or knows this problem or has had it and then had a fix, please email us in because we would love to share that information with not just this reader, but obviously the many people that are having that problem.
Fun game, though.
Yes, let's go a few Twitter questions here. We've got one from Eddie Bishop. Says, will SLI or Crossfire on the Intel 1156 boards affect USB 3.0 performance because of the limited PCI Express bandwidth?
I have no idea. I'm actually really curious.
I have a good idea. The answer is probably not, because if you have SLI or Crossfire, both of those will be going through the PCI Express on the North Bridge of that's on the processor itself. The 1156 processors integrate PCI Express into the CPU. Chances are the USB 3 controller, as well as any SATA 6.0 gigabit per second controllers, are integrated through the Southbridge PCI Express bandwidth, which on the P55 chipset, I believe, is by 4 Gen 1, which is about 500 megabytes per second. So that's kind of, I think USB 3.0 is at about 600 megs per second as its theoretical maximum, but 500 megs a second is obviously more than enough, I think, to satisfy any of the accessories and devices that exist today and for the next year. So my guess is no, that won't be a problem. The only time I've seen this be a problem is if somebody's using a SATA 6G controller and a SATA 6G and a USB 3.0 controller on the same motherboard, and they're accessing them both heavily at the same time. Then you might have some PCI Express bandwidth issues, but otherwise it hasn't really been a problem with all the implementations we've seen.
This is obviously something that's on the mind of the audience. Daniel E. West at Ryan Trout: with an SLI board, if I add a USB 3 SATA 3 card in the PCI Express slot, will I lose performance running my GTX 280 at 8x speed?
Wow, I didn't even realize I did that. Nice.
It's on the mind of the people.
So the answer is there, no. So there you go. Well, actually, no, this is slightly, I guess it's a slightly different question, right? So he has an SLI and he wants to put the PCI Express based USB 3 SATA 6 card into that second primary slot, and therefore it will reduce it from by 16 to 2x8s. No, a single GTX 280, actually any single graphics card you have today will not be choked down by a move from 16 to 8x bandwidth rates. So
2 years from now, who knows?
That's
Zen
true.
Productions. Well, yeah, but let's wait until 2 years from now when we actually see like 4 terabyte graphics cards and you know, people are spending days downloading video game levels. Zen Productions at Ryan Trout: from what you know now, which processor family makes you smile more, Sandy Bridge or Fusion? I'm laying my money on Sandy Bridge.
Do I take this question as which name is the funniest, or do I take this as?
I just assumed it was a straight like performance question. Now that's an entirely different way of looking at it. Well,
I'm sure he meant the performance.
Sandy Bridge is much funnier than Fusion.
Yeah, that definitely is. I would say gut instinct right now, still Sandy Bridge, because I know what to expect for Intel in terms of the CPU performance, and I'm hopeful on what they can do on the GPU performance. I don't think either product is really going to be an enthusiast part. It's not going to replace discrete graphics for anybody that really listens to this show on their primary system. You know, say if you have an extra system, then that's a completely different story that you don't game on, but you just need everyday stuff for. Sandy Bridge makes me smile more right now because it's going to be out sooner, and I'm going to get to play with it before the end of the year. So
that's
my
plus.
Reasoning for it, yeah.
All right, we got one more Twitter question as I move into the sunlight once again, this nasty natural lighting. Cornelius, 0_0 at Ryan Schrout, what's the biggest oh crap moment either one of you have had while overclocking? My biggest oh crap moment was not overclocking. It was simple benchmarking of a Cyrix CPU. It was one of the first 8 CPUs they taped of a new CPU they had running. And I don't know if Intel and AMD still do this, but the way Cyrix did their accounting was you took the entire development cost of the CPU, and then you basically divided that against the number of CPUs had been made to get like sort of the estimated, I'll call it the insurance cost of the CPU. So the rough value of this CPU, they probably taped out like 100, 200 of them at this point. But they were basically like, this is a $50,000 CPU. And this was very early in my benchmarking career, and I learned something that was later followed up by a terrible fire, a very small but still terrifying fire in the labs facility, is that when somebody ships you a complete machine, you open the box up and you make sure that all of the cards are still seated in their slots, all of the memory is still seated in their slots, and that the cooler has not come shifted at all on the CPU. Because the part overheated like 20 minutes into the first benchmark, crashed the system, and I'm like, what's going on? And I open up the case, and I see the fans kind of half hanging off the CPU, and the CPU basically permanently scars my finger. It was so hot, and I'm freaked because I'm like, I'm now, oh my God, I've just killed a $100,000 CPU. I'm going to be paying this off for the rest of my life. And fortunately, it cooled down. I got the heat sink back on, and it cooled down. And ran perfectly, flawlessly, and actually was an ass kicker apart for the money at the time. So that was my biggest oh stuff moment.
I have a somewhat similar one. It was when many years ago, the first AMD dual core parts, or no, it wasn't even dual core. It was just like the first like 1.3 gigahertz AMD Athlon Thunderbird part. And if you remember back then, the processors came with just the dies were exposed. They didn't have heat spreaders back then.
Yes, and I broke three of those.
Yes, yes. This was a review sample that I'd gotten in that I had to work very hard to get. It was like one of the first times I'd ever gotten a sample from the company up front and this kind of thing. And two things happened to me. That was one of the times where they had like the film over the thermal paste that was pre-installed.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't remove that at first. Now, I smelled the melting plastic, figured that out very quickly, cleaned it up, didn't hurt anything. But apparently when I reinstalled it, I broke one of the corners of the said Thunderbird processor, thereby breaking it and killing, it was going to be a $900 or $1,000 processor when it was released anyway. Plus I had it 2 months early for testing and benchmarking. And it was one of my most awkward calls into any vendor, being like, I got some news. I don't know what to do about this. I was like 19 years old or something at the time. It was pretty nerve wracking. Now if I break somebody's stuff, I just call them up and say, hey, I broke your crap. Send me something new. Otherwise I can't do the article. It's a lot more casual now, but.
It's amazing the terror of the early days in this one. Do we have time for one more Twitter question?
Yeah, sure.
Jeff Gouger at Patrick Norton just bought AS Rock to use as a home theater PC with tuner. I am looking for a suggestion for software to run media. I use Windows 7. Is WMC best? I would start actually with Windows Media Center. Robert Herron, my co-host on HD Nation, is an even more rabid fan of Windows Media Center than I am. Does an awesome job. You know, DVD playback, you're going to have to buy some additional software for Blu-ray playback, but it integrates the Windows Media Center interface. Windows Media Center. I think it's my personal favorite at this point.
I agree with that. I mean, I don't have a whole lot of experience with things outside of it, but I've been pretty happy with their experience so far. So
And for anybody who hasn't known, ASRock is now claiming they're sort of the number one in front USB 3.0 ports on motherboards now, I think it is. So
yes,
I'm actually kind of into that. The idea, I want all my ports to be USB 3.0 now that I have discovered the glory that is USB 3.0.
ASRock does interesting things like that, that you would think little things that any motherboard manufacturer could do, they just kind of jump on them first. So not too bad. So I guess that's going to round up the show for this week. Again, we definitely like the emails, the feedbacks. If you've got more complicated questions that don't quite fit in that 140 character limit, this week we'll tell you once again, email ryan@twit.tv, and we will filter through your questions and possibly give you some answers. I can't guarantee everything we say will always be correct, but we give it our best shot, right?
We'll do our best.
You can't ask for more than that from anybody you know. Patrick, where can we find you outside of the wonderful This Week in Computer Hardware?
Techzilla.com, TEKZILLA.com is the video program I do. Well, it's basically it's Happy Geek Fun with Veronica Belmont and HDNation.tv, which is the all home theater from HDPCs to Blu-ray to new releases to places to find HD content online. It's all HD and home theater gear. That's at HDNation.tv. And Mr. Shrout, where can we find you?
Well, I'm in a mystery place today, but if you want to find my work, PC Perspective is the name of the website, pcper.com. We do a lot of reviews. We have a different podcast over there as well that you guys can check out, and cover all the news and hardware and goodies such as that. Hardware and technology, it's all about that good stuff. So we will see everybody next week. If you want to watch us record the show live, by the way, you can do so at live.twit.tv. We record it every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And who knows, maybe next week, Patrick and I will be at even more different locations than we are this week.
And I promise I won't be outside again.
Not a problem. It's like a little guessing game. You never know what you're going to get with us. So that's This Week in Computer Hardware. And we thank everybody for listening.